At Public.com, you can earn 5.1% APY with a high-yield cash account. And while we can't say it's officially the highest interest rate out there, we can say this. It's higher than Robinhood, SoFi, Wealthfront, Capital One, and the big banks, too. Ready to start earning 5.1% APY on your cash? Check out the high-yield cash account on Public.com. This is paid for by Public Investing. 5.1% APY as of March 26, 2024, and is subject to change. A high-yield cash account is a secondary brokerage account with Public Investing, member FINRA/SIPC. Funds from this account are automatically deposited into partner banks where they earn a variable interest and are eligible for FDIC insurance. Neither Public Investing nor any of its affiliates is a bank. U.S. only. Learn more at public.com/disclosure/high-yield-account.
Marketplace is produced in association with the University of Southern California.
Coming up on the broadcast today, forget what you call it. Here's what we want to know. Does all that Black Friday branding actually make us want to buy stuff? And while we're at it, a look at Walmart, their low, low prices, and their labor practices. From American Public Media, this is Marketplace.
Make it a working lunch. Listen to the Marketplace Midday Update podcast for the day's top business headlines. Subscribe on iTunes or at marketplace.org/podcasts.
From the Frank Stanton Studios in Los Angeles, I'm Kai Rizdahl. This is the Marketplace podcast for Monday, the 26th of November. Glad to have you with us. Cyber Monday, I should have said. That magical day on the calendar where we're all supposed to spend money online after, that is, we presumably shopped till we dropped on Black Friday. Comscore, the people who keep track of these kinds of things, figures we're going to spend a record $1.5 billion online today. And then don't forget about Small Business Saturday, not to mention the new kid on the block, Giving Tuesday, philanthropy's contribution, if you will, to this season of spending. And really, branding and marketing is all well and good, but does any of it work? We asked Marketplace's Dan Bobkoff to help us figure out what's in a name.
Have you had enough yet?
Going to Macy's Black Friday sale.
Small Business Saturday.
A Cyber Monday sale.
And now on November 27th, we have Giving Tuesday.
It is getting a little out of hand, I think.
That's linguist Ben Zimmer. He says this has become the holy week of shopping.
Ash Wednesday starting Lent, and then Maundy Thursday, Good Friday, Holy Saturday, Easter Sunday. So perhaps consumerism as our new religion is mimicking that to some extent.
But are these shopping days losing their punch? Already we're seeing retailers try to one-up each other. Cyber Monday has become Cyber Week. Black Friday started Thursday. Peter Shankman is a branding expert.
So the concept of a specific day when people are supposed to do this is irrelevant.
Comscore estimates online retailers will sell just about 25% more today than an average Monday during the holidays. Analysts say sometimes these branded days just focus spending that would have happened anyway. That hasn't stopped nonprofits from getting into the act. Giving Tuesday encourages people to give back after they're shopped out. Saul Adler is with the 92nd Street Y in New York, which led the effort.
There are 2 days that are good for the economy, or maybe there's 3 days that are good for the economy, and there's 1 day that's good for the soul, and that's Giving Tuesday.
And while the other guys are offering free shipping or doorbuster sales, only Giving Tuesday can get you a tax deduction. In New York, I'm Dan Bobkoff for Marketplace.
Mary Shapiro said today she's moving on. She's the chairman of the Securities and Exchange Commission. President Obama named Elise Walter, one of five existing commissioners, as her successor in carrying out the SEC's mission, which is, and I quote, to protect investors, maintain fair, orderly, and efficient markets, and facilitate capital formation. So how's it doing so far? From Washington, Marketplace's David Gura has that story.
The SEC isn't a big agency. Its annual budget is just about $1.5 billion. That's not much more than what the U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service gets. But the SEC has a lot to do. Jeffrey Manns teaches securities law at George Washington.
Everything dealing with Wall Street in some way, shape, or form comes and rests at the SEC's feet.
And Wall Street is a different place today than it was when Congress created the agency after the Great Depression. Hillary Sale is a law professor at Washington University in St. Louis.
The markets have grown and changed. The complexity is dramatic. And it's very hard to keep a pace of that.
Especially when Congress controls the SEC's budget. In 1941, the federal government needed office space. It decided the SEC was a non-essential agency and moved it to Philadelphia. Adam Pritchard teaches law at the University of Michigan.
Obviously, the war effort, beating the Nazis and the Japanese, was a much higher priority than policing the New York Stock Exchange.
The SEC moved back to Washington in 1947. Jeffrey Mann says the agency's mandate grew again after the most recent financial crisis. It was charged with writing and enforcing dozens of new rules, but all that is running behind schedule.
I think there certainly is a case that the SEC does lack the resources it needs to handle the vast scope of its responsibilities.
Critics say the agency hasn't been proactive enough, that it's had trouble anticipating problems. Still, its supporters argue one important thing hasn't changed since 1934. U.S. financial markets need some kind of watchdog. In Washington, I'm David Gura for Marketplace.
Speaking of securities and exchanges, kind of a so-so day on Wall Street. We'll have the details when we do the numbers. Consider this the next time you tweet about a stock tip. The FBI's New York division might well be watching. There was an article that we saw on Reuters today about the FBI using social networking to break securities fraud cases. So we called April Brooks. She is the special agent in charge of the criminal division at the FBI's New York offices. Agent Brooks, welcome to the program.
Thank you.
So how does this work? I mean, it can't possibly be a bunch of y'all sitting around on your iPhones all day checking Twitter, right?
Correct.
So seriously, how does it work?
I mean, we have several agents. Obviously, securities fraud and insider trading, financial crimes are some of our most significant threats here in New York. One of the things that we do, we use all available techniques, whether that's using your traditional wires or cooperating witnesses or even monitoring entities like Twitter and Facebook.
So what might a red flag be? Because nobody's going to go out there on Twitter and say, I just, you know, told somebody something about something and they're going to buy this stock.
Right. Absolutely. And red flags are, you know, there's not any one particular issue or incident that's a red flag. I mean, you know, we're a human organization. We talk to people on the street. Whether it's a person on Wall Street, whether it's someone from a business, 99% of our information comes from the public or human sources.
Do you know when you see a certain pattern or a certain stream of things coming across Twitter or Facebook? Do you know that it's something you ought to follow? I mean, how do you know?
You know what? If what I'd like to do is toss that over to Dave, who's one of my supervisors,
sure.
And let him talk about a little bit more of the granular information. Dave, you want to address that question?
All right. Dave, come on, man.
Hi. Hi, sure. It's David Shouse, supervisory special agent with the FBI here
Excellent.
In New York.
So how do you know, Dave? Are you going to be able to find something like Roger Ottenham, the big insider trading case from a number of months ago, or is it going to be more broad than that?
You know, I think the Raj case really is just one of many possibilities. Do we find the next Raj case in Twitter? I can't say for sure, but that possibility exists. Varied methods of communication are being used, whether it's with gaming systems, with drop phones, through coded cryptic messages in these social networks. The possibility always exists, and it's our job to be very proactive in trying to identify those risks.
So if I'm using the chat function on Words with Friends, you guys watching that too?
I won't get into specifics about what we are and aren't, but certainly we would have to predicate and have a reason to be looking at any particular communication.
All right, super. Thank you both very much.
No problem. Thanks a lot.
Thank you.
That was April Brooks. She is the special agent in charge of the criminal division at the FBI's offices in New York City, and her boss listening in, unbeknownst to me, supervising special agent Dave Shaws. Shares of Netflix were off about 1% or so today, a reflection perhaps of the real-life drama that the movie rental company is dealing with. Billionaire investor Carl Icahn owns almost 10% of Netflix. There has been some talk he wants to push it into looking for a buyer. Thing is, not so long ago, Icahn might have just done the corporate raider thing and bought the company himself, kind of the way he took over TWA back in the 1980s. These days, though, the idea of the corporate raider has given way to a kinder, gentler approach. Our senior business correspondent, Bob Moon, has more.
I am not a destroyer of companies. I am a liberator of them.
That's the indelible image most of us have of the corporate raider, Gordon Gekko, the greedy take-no-prisoners character in the 1987 movie Wall Street. These days, there are still big investors out to liberate companies, but they go by a more politically correct name, activist investors.
The term raider suggests short-term profits. The term activist investor suggests longer-term value.
Charles Elson heads the Center for Corporate Governance at the University of Delaware. He says when corporate raiders targeted companies, stockholders sometimes got burned, but they see activist investors as a helpful, constructive influence.
The more successful you are at convincing others that you're creating long-term value, the more successful you will be in ultimately profiting from the position you've taken.
Carl Icahn typified the corporate raider in the 1980s, buying TWA and selling off many of the airline's key assets before it went bankrupt. He's shifted to an activist investor strategy in recent years, buying up stakes and pushing for changes in management or the sale of companies such as online giant Yahoo. His goal is to improve stock values. Ken Esquire watches these corporate shakeup campaigns at the research firm 13D Monitor.
The activist is coming in, telling the market how bad management is, telling them, you know, what changes need to be made. Things like that benefit all the shareholders.
If the new strategy is indeed better, that is, hedge fund manager William Ackman bought a big stake in JCPenney and handpicked a new chief executive, but the chain has continued to languish. Even so, Squire says investors who've watched their stock market returns shrink in recent years are quick to embrace these activist campaigns, and they're getting results.
Boards and management are much more receptive to listening to activists than they used to be.
A firm that tracks activist investor campaigns found that in the past 5 years, they won at least one board seat in over half their shakeup efforts. It's easier than a full takeover, but Carl Icahn hasn't entirely given up on making buyout offers. At the Boston law firm Goodwin Procter, attorney Joseph Johnson has represented both activist investors and their targeted companies. He considers Icahn something of a hybrid.
Not only is he willing to run director candidates, but in some cases he's willing to buy the whole business. Most people aren't willing to do that.
And Gordon Gekko aside, Professor Charles Elson argues that corporate raiders have actually been a positive influence.
The raiders paved the way for shareholder activism. Raiders were not a bad thing in the sense that they raised questions about the competence and effectiveness of management.
And that, Elson says, can be good for all shareholders. I'm Bob Moon for Marketplace.
Coming up,
there is a bit of a problem, which is that the gold was not in Fort Knox, but it was actually in New York.
You know, sometimes those bad guys in the Bond movies, they ain't so smart. But first, let's do the numbers. Well, after a Thanksgiving week rally, stocks ended mixed today. The Dow Industrials off 42 points, about a third of 1%, closed at 12,967. The S&P 500 shaved off 2 points, 0.2%, ended at 1406. But the Nasdaq bucked the trend, added 9 points, about a third percent, finished at 2976. Retail stocks were a mixed shopping bag, depending on whether those bags were real or virtual. Brick-and-mortar stores didn't fare too well. Shares of Macy's gave back 4.5%. Target unraveled 2.75%. Sears refunded 1.33%. But it does seem investors bought into that whole Cyber Monday thing. Shares of eBay were bid up nearly 5%. Amazon delivered an increase of 1.5% today. Bond prices, why they rose. The yield on the 10-year T-note fell to 1.66%. And you are listening to Marketplace.
Get Marketplace's top headlines, podcasts, and special features delivered right to your inbox each day. Subscribe to the Midday Update newsletter at Marketplace.org.
From the Marketplace Datebook, here's a glance at events coming up Tuesday. In Washington, President Obama meets with President-elect Enrique Peña Nieto of Mexico at the White House. How is everyone feeling about the economy? Naughty or nice? The Conference Board releases its November Consumer Confidence Index. And musician Jimi Hendrix was born in Seattle on tomorrow's date. He would have been 70. I'm Michelle Phillippe.
This is Marketplace from APM. I'm Kai Rizdahl. Okay, so here's an underreported crime I'm going to bet you hadn't heard about yet. Stealing plastic pallets, that is, those heavy-duty plastic trays and crates that are used for deliveries to grocery stores and restaurants. Officials in Southern California say there has been a virtual epidemic of plastics theft here. And Marketplace's Sarah Gardner reports pallet pilfering is happening all over the country.
It's actually gone way beyond pilfering. Authorities estimate businesses lose up to $500 million a year to plastic pallet and crate thieves. Lewis Taffer is chief marketing officer for a company that makes pallets with radio frequency ID tags. He says typically it's a few guys in a van at midnight stealing pallets left on loading docks behind supermarkets.
That's all it really takes to steal these pallets, transport them into the facility, regrind them, and do business with other unsavory people.
Taffer's talking about recycling facilities where thieves now get about 15 cents a pound for high-grade plastic. May not sound like much, but some pallets weigh 100 pounds. Plastic's value has gone up in recent years, along with the price of petroleum. The crime's especially a problem in Southern California, which has a lot of recyclers and easy access to the Asian market. Bill Cruzy at Rockview Farms, a California dairy, says some recyclers don't know they're buying hot plastic, but others do.
They operate behind closed doors, you know, bigger warehouses, behind tall fences. A lot of them don't even advertise what kind of business they are.
Authorities say the black market in plastics is sort of like the one for copper wiring, except plastic is easier to steal. Now, more cops are on the lookout. So next time you need milk crates to store all that junk in your garage, don't even think about it. I'm Sarah Gardner for Marketplace.
For all the attention that's being paid today to stories of Black Friday and Cyber Monday, there is more than just shopping to report. At as many as 100 Walmart stores, sales clerks and warehouse workers and their labor union allies have been protesting wages and working conditions. So over the next couple of days, we're going to meet some of those warehouse workers. We're going to look at Walmart's network of temporary contractors who keep its supply chain humming. And we're going to look at how we all benefit from those famous low, low prices. From the Wealth and Poverty Desk, Marketplace's Mitchell Hartman has the first in our series.
I'm trying hard not to get run over by a steady stream of Walmart trucks. They grind and screech past me down the approach road to Walmart warehouse number 6909 in Mira Loma, California, about 50 miles east of the port of Los Angeles. Javier Rodriguez works here.
Right now, what's arriving is merchandise for different Walmart destinations, and our job here is to sort it and send it in trailers all over the United States.
They move everything here, from toys to electronics. This is what's called a cross dock. Goods, mostly imported from Asia, come in from vendors like Mattel. Workers run them across the loading dock, then reload them right away into Walmart trucks.
In este caso, como yo, que soy un driver, forklift driver.
Rodriguez makes $10 an hour as a forklift driver. He's got four kids. Now that his shift's over, he's off to the second warehouse job he works to make ends meet.
You're gonna hurt yourself.
Victor Codillo lives nearby in a rundown apartment with his wife, two kids, a brother, and cousin. Codillo works at the same warehouse. He's what's called a lumper. He loads Walmart boxes by hand. That's an $8 an hour job, but he rarely gets 40 hours.
32, 34 hours a week, taking home probably 190 to 220 max.
Carillo's been there a year. Like Rodriguez, he's classified as a temporary worker, so no sick time, no vacation, health, or retirement benefits. He says the work's grueling and not very safe.
Our ramps, your wheels will get caught, and all your freight falls. Our carts, sometimes the wheels don't even work with that extra 1,000 pounds on it, impossible to pull. Our water, sometimes we don't even have water.
Now, the warehouse where Codillo and Rodriguez work moves goods exclusively for Walmart, but it isn't owned or operated by the giant retailer. Instead, Walmart contracts with a company called NFI to run the warehouse. NFI then contracts with temporary staffing agencies to hire and supervise the workers, several hundred of them. Javier Rodriguez explains.
La agencia se llama Warstaff.
The agency is Warstaff. But Werestaff works for NFI, and NFI works for Walmart.
Rodriguez, Codillo, and other workers are organizing for better wages and conditions with help from the labor coalition Change to Win, which includes the Teamsters. Their group, Warehouse Workers United, has staged strikes and charges that workers have been fired or had their hours cut in retaliation. NFI spokeswoman Kathleen Hessert responds.
Absolutely, NFI says there has been no retaliation. Whether something has been damaged or not, obviously when you're moving a lot of product, there's going to be equipment that is damaged. Lack of water, totally false.
Hessert says the workers are fabricating problems to support their union efforts. Hessert also confirms that 90% of the workers in the warehouse are temps. The dramatic rise in permanent temp workers across the warehousing industry is a problem, say regulators who monitor the industry. The perma-temps are shuffled between staffing agencies that sometimes underpay them or don't provide proper equipment. If the workers complain, they're easily replaced.
Many of the workers my office have interviewed are characterized as temp workers, but they've been working for 4, 6, 8 or more years for the same warehouse.
Julie Sue is California Labor Commissioner. Last year, her department issued more than $1 million in fines for wage theft and other violations against a staffing agency on contract to provide workers at another Walmart warehouse.
The use of this kind of subcontracting is really meant to certainly cut costs, but also to make it more challenging to enforce the law in those workplaces. And it creates ultimately a very unstable, contingent workforce that is very, very vulnerable to abuse.
Warehouse labor groups from Southern California and Chicago traveled to Bentonville, Arkansas, Walmart's home office, last month. They got a meeting with company executives, their first ever. Walmart VP of Communications David Tovar provided this prepared statement to Marketplace after the meeting.
Recently, some workers at third-party warehouses we use to move merchandise have raised some concerns about their work environment. And even though these workers aren't employed by Walmart directly, we're taking these allegations very seriously. The fact is, we hold all of our service providers to high standards and remain committed to ensuring that workers throughout our supply chain are treated with dignity and respect.
You have candy?
Back in Southern California, Victor Codillo says he'd welcome that respect. His wife, Mary, would welcome a higher paycheck and full-time hours.
During the end of the month, it gets pretty crazy with food. Like, we're on the last bits. We, like, eat top ramen or cereals, you know. But it gets hard.
Tomorrow, we'll look at whether perma-temping in the warehouses is designed to keep costs and prices low at Walmart and other big-box retailers. I'm Mitchell Hartman for Marketplace.
There's a slideshow of the temps that Mitchell talked to and the warehouses that they work in on our website. It is marketplace.org. Skyfall, the latest James Bond movie, is still going strong. It was second at the box office over the Thanksgiving weekend, right behind Twilight, actually. But we do business in economics, not vampires. And we saw an article in Vulture today that we just had to follow up on about the economic viability of the nefarious plots those Bond villains come up with. Jean-Jacques Détier is an economist and research manager at the World Bank. Thanks for coming on.
Thank you, Kai.
So we saw this thing at Vulture.com, and we just had to call you up and chat about it, because really, it's a great idea, right? Which of these Bond villain schemes actually might work? There are what, 26 Bond villains now?
Something like that, 25, 26. Yeah.
All of which basically involve somebody either wanting to take over the world or take over some market, right?
That's right. Doesn't anybody?
Well, that's right. Which one do you like? I've got my favorite. I'll tell you about it later. But which one do you like?
My favorite, without any doubt, is Goldfinger.
Goldfinger. He's the man. The man with the Midas touch.
Now, remind us what the plot is, because that one's my favorite, too. So this is going to be a quick interview, if that's
well,
the way this goes.
Well, Goldfinger, who was Gerrit Froberg, wanted to take over the Fort Knox and steal the
the gold and irradiate it so that it would be worthless and he could be the master of the world. It's that simple.
Yeah, and in theory it works, right? So all the gold in Fort Knox is radioactive, except there's a fatal flaw.
There is a bit of a problem, which is that the gold was not in Fort Knox, but it was actually in New York.
That's right. Now, there's another one I wanted to ask you about. A View to a Kill, Christopher Walken wants to trigger an earthquake in Silicon Valley.
I propose to end the domination of Silicon Valley.
That's right. It was a great movie, actually. The only problem was that actually microchips weren't actually manufactured in Silicon Valley, right? They were manufactured mostly in China and other places. But once again, despite this little problem, it was a great movie.
There's a pattern here, right? People want to create monopolies and get all the world's wealth for themselves. That's sort of the theme of pretty much every Bond movie ever.
Yeah, and that's the theme of, you know, economics to a large extent, actually. Once you have an innovation, once you have created something, some invention, I mean, you want to monopolize it. And if you don't have it, you want to steal it and you want to take it away from others if you're a bad guy. I mean, that's history, right?
Now, if the producers of the next Bond film called you up and said, listen, we need a plot device, we need a line, what would it be? How would you do it?
Ooh, I'd probably center it around China, no?
Oh, I mean, yeah.
I mean, I'm not quite sure what I would do, but there are lots of stories around rockets to the moon.
So the Chinese have like $1.something trillion worth of U.S. Treasury sitting in the Bank of China.
Mm-hmm.
There's got to be something there.
That's a good one, yeah. That could be. I think they should call you, not me, then.
Yeah, I've got a day job already. Jean-Jacques Tétier is the research manager in development economics at the World Bank. We asked him in to talk about Bond villains and how viable they really are, which, you know, some of them are, some of them aren't. JJ, thanks very much for your time.
My pleasure, Kai.
Marketplace is produced in association with the University of Southern California's Annenberg School for Communication and Journalism.
This final note today for the central bank aficionados among you. The new head of the Bank of England is a Canadian. Mark Carney, who until today was the governor of the Bank of Canada, has gotten the Queen's blessing to run the Bank of England. Not for nothing, but the Canadian dollar, the loonie as it's known, fell today against the greenback. All right, we're done. That's Marketplace from 8 p.m. on this Monday. Our producers include Bridget Bodner, Millie Jefferson, John Ketchum, Megan Larson, Joel Patterson, and Jolie Podokas. I'm Kai Rizdal. I'm in New York City tomorrow for a chit-chat with Warren Buffett. We'll have that conversation for you on the broadcast tomorrow afternoon. Have a good night. This is 8 p.m.
The world can be a confusing place for kids, and finding the words to explain it all can be tricky, too. Introducing Million Bazillion, a Webby-winning podcast from Marketplace that takes your kids on exciting adventures to answer the awkward and complex questions they have about money. Each week, we tackle hard-hitting inquiries from kid listeners like,
what is a college account and how does it work?
I want to know what unions are and what they are for.
Why does the U.S. have so much gold in Fort Knox and what do they use it for?
Help your kids understand how money fits into the world around us. Listen to Million Bazillion wherever you get your podcasts.